This is an ABC podcast.
People think they're cute, but they are fierce little things. Yeah, they got this hook on the end of their beak, right? And they grab you, and then the trick is not to pull away. You pull away, and that little hook is going to slice your skin open, right? And then you're going to bleed everywhere. The trick is now, and it's taken me a little while to get used to it, the trick is just to wait, let them do their thing. So they get their hook in, and then they twist from side to side, side to side, and then sometimes they'll flipper-slap you as well, so...
Oh, the indignity! Being flipper-slapped as well!
Hook-beaked, biting, bloodthirsty birds. Little penguins. Yeah, they're cute, but are they dangerous? Welcome to What the Duck with me, Dr. Anne Jones. And for a start, I'm going to answer two questions that I get a surprising amount, actually. Yes, penguins are birds. But instead of having flappy wings, they have slappy flippers instead. And second up, you can still call them fairy penguins if you want. There is no politically correct conspiracy behind the common name these days being little penguin. They've had lots of names over lots of time, and this one is just what the scientists call them. And thirdly, I'm going to be on ABC TV this week with a doco called Meet the Penguins. You can see it on Tuesday, the 28th of June at 8:30 on the TV, but you can watch it anytime after that on ABC iView from anywhere in Australia.
My name is Paula Wozniak and I am a Research Technical Officer with the Phillip Island Nature Parks.
And you're a penguin nerd?
Yes.
How long have you been a penguin nerd for?
So I've been employed in this role for 13 years, but I did my honours with the penguins and I did volunteer work with the penguins. So it's about 15 years worth of penguin nerdery.
Paula and I have become mates after spending months tromping around the penguin colony for the TV show. And I have to say, she's thoroughly converted me to be a penguin nerd as well. But not everyone who works with penguins is quite so in love with them.
I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of penguins, particularly little penguins.
Mel Wells is working towards a PhD with the University of Tasmania, and her topic, unfortunately for her, is on little penguins.
It's funny because actually I really like seabirds, and the reason why I like seabirds is because they're the only group of animals that exploit the interface between the sea and air, and of course penguins don't do that, they don't fly. And I've just kind of fell into it, to be honest with you. Like, I mean, I love them, they're so adaptable.
Aw, see, that's nice.
Incredibly tenacious little things.
Okay, I feel you're stretching, Mel.
But they don't have the most charismatic of personalities, I guess.
Ouch.
You know, they are one of very few species of seabirds that have been able to persist among the human-wildlife interface, you know, like, that are able to colonise these incredibly urbanised environments. I mean, we have little penguin populations within kilometres of every southern Australian capital city, which is, I don't know, for me, that blows my mind.
Yeah, if you've been over to Manly in Sydney, you might have come across a penguin or two. Kerry Doyle did. She's a listener and sent me in this sound from the Yacht Club. Nice recording, Kerry. And if you're in Melbourne, you might have seen several thousand penguins at St Kilda. Literally, the city lights are twinkling, there's drunk people doing burnouts and jumping off piers, and the little penguins are moaning and gasping like they were meant to be. What is going on? What enables them to be able to do that?
They are very adaptable. They have one of the most restricted foraging ranges of any seabird, so they're very localised in where they feed.
Oh, is it something to do with the fact that, you know, we like to put cities in rich resource places? That's where we put cities. We put them in harbours where rivers are spewing stuff into the ocean, you know, like, so maybe we have the same habitat preferences.
Well, totally. I mean, yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. Hey, like, you think of, like, Botany Bay or Port Phillip Bay or whatever, and you know, little penguins are amazing. You know, their name means good little diver, but they are pretty small, and so they can't really cope with these huge, you know, oceanic environments that are, like, you would associate with, like, in the subantarctic and, you know, sort of deep southern ocean stuff. So maybe they also are preferentially sort of preferring these kind of inshore environments. Mm. That could make sense. Yeah, I don't know. It's always blown my mind that they persist in these really urbanized environments. And I have this automatic lens that they are, you know, anthropogenic influence, human influence is a negative thing. And I certainly think that's true, but it does blow my mind that they are persisting, you know. And so I guess I'm interested in kind of teasing apart what our impacts may be on them, on their health, if we are having them.
Yeah, I reckon I suffer from this bias too. It's sort of a fatigue, I think, that comes from reading about environmental impact stories and making them all the time. It means that even when I hear something amazing, like little penguins persisting in our cities, I automatically think of the big, bad human element. But luckily, Mel is a scientist, and she's going to quantify some of the anthropogenic impacts on penguins in her PhD, because despite being pretty darn iconic and special, there's heaps we don't know about the smallest of penguins.
I'm interested in measuring little penguin health around Tasmania. Tassie's thought to be the population stronghold in Australia. Apparently we have over 65% of the Australian population, which is really based on one decades old estimate, but they are very ubiquitous around here. And one of the main reasons is because we don't have foxes. And so on the mainland, you know, they've really been restricted to offshore islands. So I'm interested in measuring a number of different indicators of health. So I'm comparing that on a spatial scale around Tassie.
Spatial scale is science talk for comparing what happens in different places.
So I've got about 15 colonies around the state, and the colonies differ based on their proximity to anthropogenic influence. And so I guess the overarching thing is I want to look at how healthy birds are in proximity to human disturbance. Every colony has its own individual suite of threats impacting them. And so I guess I'm just kind of interested in teasing them out, hopefully having some applied management implications.
It's pretty crazy, really, that the penguins sort of walk amongst us. And not least of all, because most people think that penguins only live in Antarctica. But of course, even our mainland ones are only ashore some of the time.
Yes, penguins breed on land, they molt on land, but they spend 80% of the time out in the ocean.
This is Paula again.
So they're basically ocean critters. So whatever is going on in the oceans, if it's something bad, it will be able to pick that up in the penguins. So the main story around, you know, the climate crisis and around little penguins is around their food. With the ocean temperatures in southeastern Australia warming up a lot faster than elsewhere, it is a significant concern. The East Australian Current, for example, is getting much warmer, much stronger than it was. We're getting tropical fish species down the coast of Tassie, for example, you know. The penguins will need to travel further to catch their fish, which means they're coming back less often for their chicks.
So while the warming ocean might not make the penguins sweat like they're in a bath per se, it does potentially make them alter their feeding patterns, which is of particular concern if they've got chicks on land somewhere that they need to get back to vomit in their mouth, you know, to feed them. But if the parent must travel further and further and further to find food, the chick can starve in between times.
Luckily here on Phillip Island, we're not seeing that at the moment. Those really strong East Australian Current waters aren't entering into Bass Strait significantly at the moment, which is wonderful for our colony in that we've overall had really successful breeding seasons the past decade. They've been, for the most part, either average or above average. We're starting to find that the breeding season's actually starting earlier, and we're getting birds double clutching, sometimes even triple clutching, which we never used to see on Phillip Island.
Clutching has nothing to do with those hoons and their cars down at St Kilda, by the way, though the St Kilda colony actually does see several clutches a season too.
And we never used to see three clutches in a season, but we're starting to see that now, which is great for our population. But of course, there are other penguin populations around the east coast, and I know similarly on the west coast as well, where that current has strengthened and the food sources potentially are moving further out because of those warm waters.
The warm currents within the feeding grounds could also bring some changes to the penguin diet.
And what we're finding now is that there's a lot of, you know, sea jellies and salps and things like that that we're now picking up in the penguin diet, much more than what we may have been picking up earlier. Whether that is because it could be two things going on. Either these ocean conditions are making more, you know, I guess jellyfish spawn, lots more jellyfish out there for the penguins to eat. They're generalist feeders, so anything they can shove in their gob, they will, including jellyfish. Or whether it's just these techniques are getting better now that we can pick them up a little bit better as well. So there might be a couple of different things going on there.
Mm, yeah, that's true, because like with such a soft-bodied thing like a jellyfish, they can you can imagine it would degrade pretty quickly whether it's gone through a digestive system or not.
Yeah, and you know, we did for a very long time use things like stomach flushing, so where we'd make the penguins vomit and then identify the hard parts in there. And, of course, there's not a lot of hard parts in a jellyfish, but if something came out as a whole, we'd be able to identify it. But with the DNA stuff now, yeah, we are getting that much more finer detail.
Just making a note to come back to vomit. So, you know, there's been a little string of relatively good years, right, for your colony of penguins on Phillip Island. But will the good times last?
Look, you know, it's something that you try not to think about too much, but you have to because it's really important. Look, it's likely that the warm waters will start encroaching more into Bass Strait. Hopefully not. But we shall see. With our penguin population, though, we are in a fortunate position in that we've managed to reduce or eradicate a lot of their other threats that they've had, especially on land. We do the weed removal work. We've reduced most of their introduced predators. So they're in a pretty good wicket that way. So hopefully they'll be able to, you know, if we take away all the other issues they may have, hopefully they'll be able to withstand these warmer temperatures. We'll see. I'm not sure. And I'm not sure when that will happen either.
How good are penguins with heat tolerance?
So we are having increased temperatures and more significant heat waves, terrestrial heat waves. That does cause an issue for the little penguins. They do get heat stressed. I think their thermal neutral zone is about 27 degrees, so anything above that, they have to actively try to cool themselves down.
Birds don't really sweat. They sort of pant to try and cool themselves. And if you're a tubby little penguin with a down coat of feathers on, panting isn't really going to cut it in the Australian summer.
And we do know, so we did have an incident again, 2019 it was, when we were in the middle of our penguin molt. So penguins go through what we call a catastrophic molt, which is a wonderful term.
Yeah, it sounds like they're going to blow up or something. And it sort of looks like that too. There'll be this angry little penguin hanging around the colony, surrounded by tens of thousands of feathers that it has just shed all at once.
But it means that they're stuck up on land for about 17 days, molting all of their feathers. They can't go into the water. They're stuck on land. They're almost double their size.
Because they've got all tubby so they can last out the molt without starving. Because without their feathers, you see, they can't swim to hunt.
So you've got these really big, heavy penguins on land. Their molt usually is in March and April. Now with shifting breeding seasons, we are getting, you know, your old molt to come up in January and February as well.
Right when it's the hottest.
And so in 2019, we had this prolonged heat event. And what we found then during that time was a lot of these big molting penguins became heat stressed to the point that they died. But we had over 100 little penguins succumb to the heat. And that was a real, you know, shake-up of, okay, well, this climate crisis is happening here and now, and our penguins are experiencing it on land, and we need to do something right now to prevent this from happening again.
And Paula is part of the team that's making things happen. There's yearly training for all staff in penguin first aid, and there's also plantings to help shade penguin burrows and create nice, cool gardens for the penguins to enjoy. The funny thing with climate change is we often have these really catastrophic images in our heads, burning fires, flooding cities, hungry animals, dying trees. But some of the impacts are going to be really different, like getting more fleas. Here's Mel Wells.
We're going to be looking at nest temperatures and how differences in nest temperatures affect the numbers of external parasites they have. So these external parasites are cold-blooded, you know, ticks, fleas or whatever, and certainly changes in environmental conditions, global warming, is favouring these cold-blooded arthropodic potential disease vectors. So certainly there is a sort of trend in the southern hemisphere of these kind of cold-blooded little parasites moving southward. And from previous research, we know that little penguin nests vary substantially in their microclimate. So I'm sort of interested in looking at that in relation to their little parasite communities.
And it's like one tick might be neither here nor there, but every animal, including humans, has like a parasite load they're able to deal with, right? And then exactly. On top of that, the potential for parasites to jump to your mate and spread a disease, especially because little penguins, I'm not going to say they're promiscuous per se, but they definitely are social with each other, right?
Totally. So I think you could say promiscuous. You can get over that.
I know, it breaks everyone's heart when you tell them that they're promiscuous.
I know.
So, it turns out that if there was a Real Housewives of Phillip Island, Penguin edition, well, ratings would be through the roof because there's sex, divorce, jealousy, drama, more sex. You get the idea.
You know, I always go back, and I don't want anyone to psychoanalyze me, yeah? But I always go back to the penguin sex, yeah?
All right, tell me more.
No, because I love because people have these romantic notions about penguins and about little penguins, you know, that yeah, they mate for life. It's like, yeah, sure, they mate for life, but with how many other penguins? They are raunchy little things. They will have multiple partners in a night. They will faithfully raise chicks with the same partner, potentially year after year. They will eventually divorce. They all eventually divorce. that's a sweeping statement. Most divorce. But they will have extra pairs on the side. And I've even seen a little penguin standing on, so when the penguins come home every night, they use the same pathway to come back to their burrow. So the same penguins use the same pathway. And there was this one penguin once when I was doing night observations, and he'd stay on the main pathway and he'd just copulate with every single female that went past.
It was a Lothario. Oh my goodness.
So, you know, I don't know if he had any sort of strong pair bond with a female, but I'm sure he got his genetics out there.
I suppose when you spend the cold days and nights out at sea, when you're in port, you're just gonna go for it. But it's more complex than just no strings attached shags. Because they can be having one night stands at the same time as having a committed relationship.
So the male will actually mate guard his female. So he will stay with her in the burrow, chasing away any other potential male that comes near her to reduce the chances of her having these extra pair copulations. And we know with some of our genetic studies that I think it's less than 10% of penguins, male penguins, rear chicks that aren't genetically theirs. So the female was able to, yeah, get in another pair, another partner in there.
Relationship red flag alert. Both promiscuous and controlling. Oof. It sounds like a toxic relationship in human terms. But what's quite fascinating is that the pair often work together in a really effective way because it's a cooperative effort to raise the chicks.
It is. So both the male and female will raise their chicks. But interestingly, most partnerships aren't equal. So there'll be one parent that does more of the parental care than the other. But it's not tied to sex, so it could be male or female.
So, I said I'd come back to vomit. How do you make a penguin vomit back in the day when you were testing their vomit?
Okay, so you'd actually have to fill them up with water and stick them upside down and then massage their bellies.
No.
Yeah, and that they would, though. We would actually make fish slurries, fish milkshakes, I think we called them, to refeed them afterwards. So they wouldn't go to bed hungry.
Yeah. That sounds absolutely disgusting.
You know, obviously, we're trying to get as hands-off as possible now with our penguin research. So that was a pretty hands-on thing to do. So we don't do that anymore.
No. You do go around like a creepy neighbour and look at what they've been pooing, though.
Yeah, but I feel like the penguins don't mind that I do that.
So can you describe your poo collection mechanism?
Look, you know, we do a lot of high-tech stuff, and this isn't. It's getting a piece of cardboard and using weed mat little pins and putting a piece of cardboard in the entrance of the penguin burrow and then just waiting for them to do their thing. So quite often, particularly the adults or your bigger chicks, they'll try to poop outside and or near the entrance of their burrow so they don't soil that burrow up too much. So they'll just deposit their goodies there. And then I go through and I've got to make sure I get the right sample, yeah? It can't just be any old poo. I've got to sift through and find the one that doesn't have any dirt or bugs in there, that's not too dry or anything like that. So when I find the nice one, I collect it.
And because this goes off for sort of more comprehensive scientific analysis in a lab, right? So that's why you don't want it to have anything in it. You're not just a poo purist.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, because this is then goes off for our DNA analysis. So obviously you don't want anything in there messing with the DNA. The dry poop, that DNA degrades really quickly. So
it is weird, though, because it is a giveaway, right? Because you can sort of see where burrows are because there'll be these splatters of, like, Jackson Pollock penguin shit coming out of them. So can you describe the act of a penguin taking a poop?
What do you mean? What, they kind of like shuffle their bottoms around?
Yeah, so they sort of shuffle their butt around and then back out the door a little bit, do they?
Yeah. And then they bend over it. You can, like, you usually can hear it and you can see it. There's actually a great paper on how strongly they poop. So it's a thing.
Yes. This is perhaps one of the best scientific papers I have ever read, and it's from the University of Kochi in Japan. And I've got to quote some of the introductory phrases because, well, look, I don't really know where the mathematics and physics ends and the art begins. Here's an abridged version. Penguins strongly shoot their feces towards their rear side. These bombings sometimes embarrass keepers. It is practically important to know how far their feces reach from origin. Such information would save keepers from the crisis. The researchers go on to calculate the trajectory through the air, the non-Newtonian liquid that is the poo, and the impact that air pressure might have on the distance, the levels of pressure inside the gut of the penguin. They point out that the penguin, even shooting across a flat surface, manages to shit its own body length along the ground. And for an average human sitting on the earth, that's the equivalent of your turd exploding 1.7 metres or so behind you. It is truly a work of art. And if you're interested in the actual result, by the way, a safety zone should be 1.34 metres away from a penguin if you want to avoid getting shat on. And that's about the, quote, maximum flying distance of a penguin's feces from a high place, end quote. Which is useful if you find yourself looking up to find a penguin with irritable bowel sitting in a tree. If you want to see some of these little penguins and their chicks, and also watch Paula and I on national television, then check out ABC TV on Tuesday, the 28th of June, 2022, for Meet the Penguins. It'll also be available on ABC iView for streaming, rewatching, and sharing. I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and I produce What the Duck, along with Patria Ladgrove. Joel Werner does the script editing, and we produce the show mainly on the lands of the Wadawurrung and Kaurna people. And I'll just leave you with this little bit of flipper slapping.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.